this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Dr. Mark Geyer and his son, David Geyer, and we're going to be talking about autism, we're going to talk about mercury, we're talking about how science, of course, is misused in America. Science, of course, is a search for the truth, but there are those people who want to cover the terrible damage they're doing to our children by using lies and distorting science, and, of course, there'll be so much evidence. All you need to do is look at the Amish children who are not, did not receive the mercury-laden vaccines, don't have the autism, they don't have the allergies and asthma and autoimmune diseases that the children and the general population do, and when they tell you that vaccines are safe and effective, they're simply lying to you. But the tragedy is so many children, about 1 in every 160 children in America today is autistic. It used to be 1 in 10,000, now it's 1 in 160, and government officials say, oh, well, we don't know why it is, but we can assure you it's not the vaccines. Well, Dr. Geyer has been on the front lines of this battle, as his son David, trying to get the truth out, and they actually have treatment centers all across America where a lot of these autistic children are getting better. But you're never going to read about that in Time, Newsweek, or Life, Time, Newsweek, or U.S. News and World Report, or the mainline media, because they're controlled by people who have an agenda. And that agenda is allowing terrible damage to be done to our children. Well, that is a background. Dr. Mark, are you there?
Hi, yes, I'm here.
And David, are you there?
Yes, I'm here as well.
All right, fine. Well, let's start out with talking to Mark. And Mark, why don't you tell us, of course, about this latest report. It was a front page of newspapers all across America. Why there was a decision by the vaccine court that none of these cases being brought, you know, for the autism in children had any merit. And the science had definitely proved there was absolutely no relationship between autism and mercury or the vaccinations. So you pick up the story.
Okay, well, basically, the decision that came down involved MMR vaccine. The vaccine court has a group of children that are claiming to be damaged and have autism. And there's over 5,000 such children. And there were three MMR vaccine test cases, as they call them. Before that, there was one thimerosal case, that is, mercury vaccine case, that was actually conceded, and that was the case of polling. Now, these three cases have decided that MMR does not cause autism. There are three more cases behind it involving whether or not mercury causes or thimerosal causes autism. And it's sort of interesting that the masters want to decide whether mercury causes autism, since already their own scientists have conceded it. But in any case, those three cases, after 2 years, almost 2 years of thinking, they've decided that there's no merit to it. And what I mean by 2 years is that the cases were filed like 10 years ago, and they actually had a hearing almost 2 years ago. It took the special masters almost 2 years to decide this. And let me explain something about the vaccine court. It is not a court in the normal sense of the word. In the United States, we have a judiciary branch, which is where our courts are, and an executive branch. This court does not belong to the judiciary branch. The court is run by Health and Human Services. The judges, or they're actually called special masters. They're not called judges because everybody knows they're not really judges.
In other words, basically, the government employees are going to do what they're told.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's HHS who runs FDA, who runs CDC, and now runs the court, says, we give the vaccines, we promote the vaccines, and by the way, the vaccines didn't cause a problem. Not exactly independent hearing. However, the result will be appealed. It will be appealed to the Federal Claims Court, which is also not a court. It runs by the executive branch. And from there, it'll be appealed to the Circuit Court, which is a real court. And that court traditionally has...
Hold that thought. All right, Mike, go right ahead. You were saying it was going to be appealed then to another court, but then it's finally going to get to the appeals court. How long is that going to take? How many more children are going to have their lives shattered before you get there?
Oh, lots. And the truth of the matter is, let's say the appeals court does what they've done in the past in other vaccine cases, which is they've overturned what the special masters have said, and they've said all the criteria that the appeal courts have said have been met. So let's say these kids are eventually compensated, these three kids. The problem is, in the vaccine so-called court, there are 5,000 or more of these kids, and it will take, you know, you can figure it out with the current rate of processing, and each case must be processed one at a time. That's by law. And no matter which way it goes, they'll be processed one at a time. It'll take 100 years to process the cases. And worse than that, these are 5,000 cases. There are millions, at least a million, probably 2 million autistics that have been affected that are not eligible for the court. So the court issue, the so-called vaccine court, has become kind of a joke to the whole thing. It's an anachronism. It's a way of trying to protect the vaccine companies from suit, and it really has very little to do with what really is happening. And as I say, overall, the science is so overwhelming on this side that virtually every major university now in the country has come out with a study of one kind or another that thimerosal, the vaccine mercury, is causative of the autism epidemic. And you know, now there are, oh, I don't know, there's five different animal systems. Harvard has done autopsies on brains of autistics, and they found mercury. You look in the environmental studies, and one thing that comes up when you're looking at autism is mercury. It's overwhelmingly proven that mercury causes the autism epidemic, and there are, as I say, thousands of studies on that side. In fact, it's becoming sort of old hat. The question now is, what can we do about treatment? The answer is a whole lot.
Well, now, what about the MMR? Why does the MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, why does that produce autism as well? Because there's no mercury in it. So what does MMR do to the child's developing brain?
Well, my feeling, incidentally, is that most of the autism, I think, after all I said about the court, I think the court's probably right that MMR is not the main cause of autism. Each of those viruses are live viruses, and they can cause damage to the brain, and they have caused damage to the brain, but they're not the main issue in autism. The main issue is the mercury, the thimerosal issue. But, however, under the court rules, they have won their case. They can't lose, because they have publications, and they have experts. And under the rules of the vaccine court, if you have experts and you have peer-reviewed publication, you win, even if the other side has more. And the court ruled that the preponderance of the evidence favored rejection, when in reality that's not even the standard of that court. But I think the main issue is not MMR. I think the main issue is thimerosal.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and apparently the case that was recently decided in the vaccine court was the measles, mumps, and rubella, and some of the children who received that vaccine have become autistic, but of course, did a lot of those children who got the MMR also have the mercury-laden vaccines?
Yeah, that's correct.
So basically, how could they say that the vaccines didn't, or it was just specifically MMR, they didn't even consider the fact that children had been poisoned with mercury, one of the most deadly toxins, poisons we know?
Well, they sort of took a poke at it in their decision. They sort of acted like they didn't believe the mercury either, but they were unable to rule on it because these were not really thimerosal test cases. And I actually argued that they should do the mercury ones first, but anyway, they did it this way.
Yeah, well, now, who is directing these cases? Or have the lawyers, as so often simply been purchased by the people on the other side? Because, you know, when you're a lawyer, you don't have to have any sense of right and wrong. You work for whoever gives you the most money, and even if you're representing people, many times they simply buy off the lawyers, so they don't do a good job. What do you think happened in this case, and why didn't they pursue the thimerosal cases rather than the MMR, where there would be a question?
Well, I think that the lawyering hasn't been really strong, but there are various issues. I don't think they bought out the lawyers on the other side. The problem with the current system under the so-called vaccine compensation court is that the lawyers don't get a percentage of the case. They are paid on an hourly basis to be determined by the court. So the lawyers on the side of the children have not been paid, and it's not clear when and if they'll ever be paid. And they have, millions of dollars tied up in these cases. And quite frankly, we have people that call us, and we're not the lawyers, and we're not, we weren't even involved in those cases, you understand, directly. And so people say, well, where do we get a lawyer to file our claim? And the answer is virtually no lawyer in the country now will file such a claim because you can't work before the act. They won't pay you until after the cases are over. The cases are over 10 years later. At that point, you file a fee petition. And then guess what? Guess who decides how much you get paid? The lawyer on the other side. And the lawyer on the other side has now recently been deciding things like, well, you know, you're a lawyer, you ask us for $300 an hour, and we think you're worth $200, $100 an hour. Oh, and we don't think you should have taken this trip. And by the way, you got three experts, we thought you needed two experts. So basically, and these guys are out of pocket, basically, the act does not work, and it's completely broken, and it's at this point really only an impediment to what should really be happening, which is, the issue should be settled in the court system. And I didn't say that every child that claims to be damaged by mercury in the vaccines was, but each person is, in my lowly opinion, as guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States, entitled to a hearing before a court, before a jury, where they'll get an independent assessment. And that's being blocked currently. But I suspect it won't be blocked much longer. I would suspect within a year there will be cases coming in real court. And then we'll let, you know, 12 honest men decide.
Do you think that there'll be mercury cases going into the courts? Can they get them through in a year? It sounds to me like the government, the FDA, the CDC, they're doing everything they can to block this. And of course, as Dr. Mark was saying, basically we're talking between 1 and 2 million American children whose lives have been destroyed and their parents' lives have been destroyed because they know. We've got some of their own material from some of their own meetings where they acknowledge, you know, in secret meetings that they knew that mercury was involved. And so they took it out of the regular childhood vaccines. Then they added it to the influenza. They made influenza vaccine, required, you know, at 6 months of age. And then they gave it to pregnant women where they knew it would do them absolute maximum damage, giving it the first trimester. Why would you give a pregnant woman a shot, an influenza vaccine that really doesn't do any good but could do immeasurable harm to her unborn child? And then you can always say, well, look, see, we took the mercury out of the childhood vaccines and the incidence hasn't gone down, so obviously it wasn't the mercury. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is that those of us who are honest in this can add. And the current recommended vaccine schedule has more thimerosal in it now, if you follow the whole schedule, than it ever had in history.
Why is that now? Because I thought they'd taken it out of all the childhood vaccines except for the influenza vaccine, which now they said they made mandatory.
Well, first of all, it isn't totally out. It's been lowered in the childhood vaccines. But the problem is the current recommended schedule is every pregnant woman should get a thimerosal-containing vaccine for influenza. Every child in the first year of life is to get two shots of influenza, thimerosal-containing primarily, and then a shot at 18 months, and then a shot every year for the first 18 years of life. And when you add that up, that's more mercury than they ever got in the days when it was in the DTP and the HIV and the hepatitis B. I mean, it's simple arithmetic. It doesn't matter which vaccine it's in. What matters is how much mercury, and those 18 shots far exceed what the children used to get. So the dose of mercury is higher. And also, the catastrophe is far larger than what you stated. It's 1 to 2 million autistics. The problem is that it is one, according to their statistics, 1 out of 6 children have ADD, ADHD, and it's just a milder form of the same problem. And in reality, it's probably more like 1 out of 3 children now have ADD, ADHD. In addition, over 50% of our children born today, this is an amazing statistic, over 50% have a chronic illness in the first 10 years of their life. They either have autism, they have ADD, ADHD, they have diabetes, they have obesity, or they have asthma. Between those, over 50%, those are all chronic illnesses. Those are the illnesses that all were epidemic when they began the vaccine. They're all likely associated with the mercury in the vaccine, and they're all terrible illnesses. And that makes our children the sickest in history. Yeah, we don't have very much infectious disease, but we sure got some good chronic disease.
Well, now, of course, do we have this much asthma? Did we have this much diabetes type 1? Did we have this much autoimmune disease before they started giving all these mercury-laden vaccines?
The answer to that is certainly not, and they're trying to pretend that we did. We say there's an autism epidemic, and they say it's genetic, and of course the next thing that comes out of our mouth, I'm a geneticist, is you can't have a genetic epidemic because it's too rapid a change. So they say, what epidemic? They were always there. We just didn't realize in the 80s that we had people with autism. So my suggestion was, let's go see the adult autistics. Only trouble is I can't find them. There's a handful of them. They're hiding an epidemic that's massive in size. And in fact, you quoted 1 in 166, which is an old quote from them. Then they went to 1 in 150, and a number of their own studies now show 1 in 96, 1 in 86, 1 in 56. And in fact, my suspicion is no one really knows, because a lot of the autistics never get counted because they're homeschooled. I would suspect, if you ask my estimate, that at the peak time, the autistic rate in the United States was somewhere between 1 in 20 and 1 in 30 children. These children's lives are just devastated. They're not, most of them don't look like the Rain Man. These are kids that are highly aggressive. Over half of them don't say a single word in their life, or maybe one word. They break their mother's arms. They break the holes in the wall. And many of them need to be institutionalized. And they're starting to come out of the school systems now. And there's no institutions to put them in. Not that I think it's a good idea to institutionalize them, but there's not much choice at this point, and we're just ignoring it. And the world is going to be a very difficult place to live in when these kids are out of school and they're not treated, or they're treated on psychiatric meds which don't really work. I just read last week that one of the 18-year-olds killed his mother. He didn't mean to, and they're charging him with murder, which is ridiculous. The kid's sick. But you're going to see that all the time now. The kids who have this kind of autism, and by the way, mercury poisoning causes aggressive behavior, and these kids have massive aggressive behavior. We're in for a very, very difficult time, and it's not just in the U.S. Wherever we've taken our vaccines, as Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has written, there has gone the autism epidemic. We took it to China, and they didn't have autism. All of a sudden, they have autism. We took our vaccines to New Zealand in the late 90s, and they started having autism. Everywhere we go, they have an autism epidemic. This is a worldwide problem, and it is the greatest problem in history. The amount of damage is greater than World War I and World War II combined. We're sitting around worrying about global warming, and as we're going right now, the way we're pouring mercury out of our smokestacks and the way we're continuing our vaccines, we're not going to find out if there's global warming in 100 years, because there may not be anybody here smart enough or able enough to measure it anymore. We are just destroying our society, and it's a terrible, terrible thing. And anybody who goes to any school system now, just go to a normal school, ask them how many kids are on Ritalin or Strattera. I live in Montgomery County. 50%, they say. 50% of our children have attention deficit, and even the ones who don't, the studies show, have lost significant IQ points. What makes the country that we love so much great? Is it our oil? Is it our food? No, you know what it is? It's our brains, the brains of our people, and that's what we're destroying. How can we remain a great nation if we have damaged the next two generations of children?
And of course, if you wanted to destroy a nation, you couldn't do a better job than the people in the CDC and the FDA and, of course, in the vaccine court. And these people know what they're doing. That is the tragedy. And was it the Simpson-Wood report that secret CDC meeting that I think we have copies of that. Was it Simpson-Wood?
That's one of many, many. Where their own documents, and they don't dispute their own documents, say that we know what caused it, and we're going to hide it. And the reason they give is, if it ever gets out, people won't take the vaccines, and the children will die, so we must never tell anybody.
But of course they don't
point it. The problem with that is, I'm not anti-vaccine, but folks, it's out. You can read that, you can see those transcripts. There actually are thousands of different transcripts that we have. And they all say the same thing. They all say they know, and they know they're going to cover it up. And therefore, no study will convince them. Every time a new study comes out of Harvard or wherever, and they call me and they're all excited, wait till they see my study, it'll convince them. I say, it won't. And they say, how do you know? And I say, there's one person you can't convince, one group you can't convince. And that's somebody who already knows and has decided they're not going to tell anybody.
And they're lying to the American people. This is the thing, because after all, there's several things. If the people realize that we're destroying the minds and the lives of our children, they'd be up in arms. They'd demand these people be fired. And, of course, a lot of these people, some of them really believe, of course, we are saving children's lives because they're not going to get the childhood diseases. But a lot of them are looking forward to a comfortable retirement, working for one of the major vaccine companies. And this has happened time and time again. If you do the right thing when you're working for government, then you can retire with all sorts of wonderful benefits. And this has happened to a number of key people who've covered up and sacrifice the lives of a future generation. Could anybody be that evil? Yes, ladies and gentlemen, they really could. We'll be right back for Dr. Mark Kier. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Well, Mark, should I talk to David or should I talk to you about your program?
Yeah, why don't you talk to David? He actually has an incredible in-depth knowledge of this. And in addition, he wants to tell you about a new book.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four tape or a four CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
I know what it's like to lay awake at night and worry about mounting credit card debt. That nagging feeling in the pit of your stomach that just won't go away, and the phone calls from collectors. Forget about it. Then I called Help You Out of Debt. Their professional staff of debt mediators were able to help me get my upside-down finances back on track and help stop the phone call. My Help You Out of Debt settlement specialist understood exactly what I was going through. My specialist was able to get creditors off my back, negotiate huge reductions on most of my balances, and help me fight back against the credit card companies. Help You Out of Debt specialists are experts in debt mediation and settlement. They are on your side. They've helped thousands of people just like me and can help you too. Call now and get a free debt review. If you're $10,000 or more in credit card or unsecured debt and ready to start fighting back, call 866-374-3101 and get your free debt review. That's 866-374-3101 or on the web at helpyououtofdebt.com.
Even the government will admit that one in six children has some sort of a neurodevelopmental abnormality, and they'll have attention, deficit hyperactivity disorder, which are simply parts of the spectrum. They're destroying the lives of probably, between one in five and one in six American children, and with the diabetes and asthma and autoimmune disease and all the other things that are associated with poisoning the children, and they know what they're doing. They're giving them more mercury now than ever. Why would you do that? Because, of course, they people have a different agenda. Well, tell us a little bit about, David, what you and your dad are doing in the way of treatment and what sort of results you're getting with these young men. Because mostly young boys, aren't they?
Yeah, autistics affect far more males than females. That's actually one of the secrets of how we found out about testosterone and autism. When one looks at mercury poisoning episodes, what you find is that over and over again, males are much more damaged than females. And the explanation behind that seems to be that testosterone makes mercury much more poisonous, whereas estrogen protects against mercury poisoning. As we've tested autistic children, I was saying we've now tested close to 600 children, what we found is that the autistic children tend to have significantly high testosterone. And high testosterone seems to correlate with many of these very serious behavior and social problems that these kids have. And so we've been using various anti-testosterone medications to treat these children. And what we're seeing with them is rather dramatic, rapid improvements. And these are things that I think would make a lot of sense to the parents who are listening that have autistic children. As I said, very often these kids they'll headbang, they'll bite, they'll pinch. These are obvious behaviors caused by high testosterone. If you took a normal kid and you injected them with testosterone, they would develop these kind of behaviors. And what we're seeing with the children with autism is that if we lower their testosterone, these kind of problem behaviors get much better fairly rapidly.
But don't you also find that it's easier to actually get the mercury out of them once you've lowered the testosterone levels?
Yeah, there's also, you're correct. There is an interaction between testosterone levels and the body's ability to excrete mercury. Mercury is a very unique poison in that when you're exposed to it, the only way that your body can really defend against it is through excretion. And the excretion of mercury involves a substance called glutathione, which is made inside of the cell. This glutathione protects cells from being mercury poisoned. And what autistics have is significantly lower levels of glutathione than normal kids. This is part of the explanation of why millions of children receive mercury in their vaccines and mercury in the environment, and only a smaller percentage, not everyone, develops it. It's because they have different susceptibility based on their ability to excrete the mercury. And testosterone actually inhibits the body's ability to excrete mercury. And so what we're finding clinically is that as we lower the testosterone, these children have an easier time detoxifying themselves of mercury because their glutathione levels rise.
Now, what sort of results are you getting? I mean, what percentage of the children do you think that you can help by lowering the testosterone and then detoxifying them?
When we test children, the autistic children that we've tested, we find over 80% show abnormally high either testosterone or other related metabolites. So this is finding this present in almost every kid with autism that we test. As far as improvements, I would say most children, there are exceptions, in science and medicine, not everybody responds positively, but most children that we treat respond very favorably. And this is not a kind of subtle thing. That's one of the things I was trying to get across. It is a dramatic change in the way these kids look. It's the kind of thing that today the child's hitting somebody, and when we start the therapy within a few days, a few weeks, the frequency of that will either become zero or become a very infrequent event. So it's very, very obvious and very significant for a lot of children.
Are you able to get some of the children out of the institutions and back into their homes?
Yeah, we've done that on a number of children, either that were going to institutions or were in institutions, and now they're back home with their families.
And, of course, what about their ability, perhaps, to speak or to dress themselves or to do the other basic functions of life?
We're finding that those improve as well, that the physical part is just the most obvious and most immediate. Over time, we're seeing improvements in socialization, even cognitive skills, and even over a longer period, that ability to speak. These kids very often will develop more words. Their receptive language will improve. It's a kind of situation when they have high testosterone.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. All right, David, go right ahead.
It's a situation when they have high testosterone. One of our parents gave a very good analogy. It's almost like they're a human Super Bowl, a lot of these kids, meaning that they're constantly in motion, whether it's physically moving around a room or if you just watch them, you'll see that their eyes are scanning, they can't concentrate, they can't focus. And when we lower the testosterone levels, those kind of things tremendously go down. For the first time, we have children who can sit on a couch and actually watch television or sit at a computer screen or sit there and do work with their teachers at school. It's just a tremendous godsend because these poor teachers that are out there who try to do, they use sometimes ABA therapy or various kinds of techniques which can help these children learn. Because they're so sick, they're unable to sort of receive that knowledge. If the kid is running around the room the entire time during the session, it's obviously not going to learn anything. And there's another unsaid thing, and for your parents that are listening, children who are 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years of age don't normally masturbate. Most of these kids do. They also have things like they'll have body hair, body odor, things that you see at puberty, and those are not normal, and they are related to testosterone. And by the way, when you lower that testosterone, they stop doing that. And most doctors won't even ask that question, but there's an obvious association there between the testosterone levels and the clinical things that we see. Go ahead, Dave. And these are things that the behaviors, a lot of parents are simply putting down these basically high testosterone behaviors that my father mentioned due to the quirkiness of autism. But the bottom line is that they're not really autism behaviors. They're behaviors associated with high testosterone. And they are a serious problem that need to be treated. They're not normal. They're things that if you treat them, they'll get much better. And it results in just amazing things that people don't even contemplate about the issue of these early sexual kind of behaviors happening. I mean, it makes it so these children, they can't go out in public. The parents, are frightened that something's going to happen to them because their kid's sexually more active than they should be at a young age. These are all things that we can really help with our therapy. And kind of Mainline Medicine's response is that they're giving psychiatric money. When we see these kids, it is a very predictable pattern. Usually in the first several years of life, the kids develop these behaviors, they start emerging, they become more problematic. The parents are so much bigger than the children that they sort of can deal with it. But by the time they get 7, 8, 9, 10 years old...
Hold that thought, David. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is Dr. Mark Geyer and his son, David Geyer. And Mark, why don't you go ahead and do you have a website that you'd like to get out or information on your clinics or how people can get their children or perhaps they know some child who really is autistic and there are real problems with them. And I know you have clinics all across America that are helping children. So why don't you give us the background, the background of where people can get in touch with you, get in touch with your website, get treatment for their children.
Yes, we have a website, ASDCenters, with an S, .com, which will get you a description of some of our therapy. It'll get you links to many. We've published many of these as peer-reviewed papers all over the place. It'll tell you a little bit about us and how to get in touch with us. If you don't have a computer, if they call 301-989-0548, they can get information or make an appointment. And it is our plan to open centers virtually everywhere because we have so many doctors now and other health professionals joining us. Right now, we have a clinic open in Seattle, Washington, in Chicago, Illinois, in Springfield, Illinois, in Indianapolis, Indiana, and we'll soon have one in Dallas, Texas, and we're opening one in New Jersey, and we plan to open soon in Florida. And pretty much we're probably going to eventually try to be in all the states because this is a therapy that really, really works. As I was quoted by one who was trying to make fun of me, this therapy works a lot better than I ever thought it would. It's an amazing therapy, and almost everybody who's on it says the same thing. It's amazing how quickly children get better. We don't cure autism, but they are the typical reaction is they're seen by their doctor. They're treated with Lupron for, let's say, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. They're seen again. and the doctor says, is this the same child? Do I have the right chart?
No, basically, Mark, give that telephone number. Once again, you always have to give your telephone number at least twice on the radio.
Okay, the website is ASD, which stands for Autism Spectrum Disorders, ASDCenters, with an S, .org, and the phone number is 301-989-0548.
All right, that's 301-989-0548. Ladies and gentlemen, there are treatments out here that are intensively being withheld. These children's lives, they're doomed. Their parents are doomed. So many parents have had, they've gone into divorce, or certainly their marriages are destroyed because of an autistic child, and it's totally unnecessary, but the evil and wicked people working within the CDC, and I know because I've been there, and I'm sure Mark has talked to them, but I was there, of course, with the AIDS epidemic, and it became very obvious they had no intention of trying to stop the AIDS epidemic in the United States, and it was just so evil. I found it almost unbelievable after being there for 2 or 3 days. I was just glad to get away. And there are people there, they're good people, I'm sure, at the CDC who want to do their job. But unfortunately, the people in key positions have an agenda, and that is not necessarily to help our children. Well, basically, now, of course, when I first talked to you about this, it must have been, a year and a half or so ago, maybe 2 years, so time flies so quickly, and I haven't talked to you in a while, but, you were just really working with it. You only had a handful of children. Now you're up to over 600 children. Are you actually following them, or are you just getting reports from the doctors who are following them?
No, we follow them. All of our units are connected by a telemedicine system, so we actually, if we're not physically present, let's say in Chicago, we actually see the children, and we actually have all the records, and we make all the decisions. We oversee every single one of them. The doctors in the other places are, learning and helping us. Our Chicago unit is particularly interesting. You mentioned about the Amish not having autism. Our Chicago unit is a unit that has about 30,000 children who are not vaccinated, and they have no autism. They became fairly famous for this.
30,000 children who have not been vaccinated, no autism, and yet, of course, maybe 1 in 50 children who are vaccinated, and they want to tell us the vaccines are safe and effective. Maybe they should be held before the criminal court because they're destroying the lives of literally millions of American children. So basically, go ahead. I just get so emotionally involved when I think of this, and I know you and your son, David, are emotionally involved in this too, and every one of our people in the listening audience should understand they're destroying a whole generation of our children, and they know what they're doing. Go right ahead.
And they don't really interfere, at least so far, they haven't interfered in our therapy. In fact, if you ask the CDC, they only know one thing about autism. It isn't caused by vaccines. And the truth of the matter is, most of them have never seen an autistic child because why would a CDC officer see an autistic child? They have to do with, distributing vaccines. And so they just go, well, the vaccines are safe. They don't cause autism. What causes autism? They don't know. What's the rate of autism? They don't know. What's going on? What are the treatments? They don't know. And it's true, probably. To some extent, it's true. They really don't know about that.
Well, the people who went to that meeting at Simpson Wood, because they actually, it was this top secret meeting, they suppressed it. This was classified, if you can believe it, until somebody, I think it was Congressman Weldon, finally was able to get a copy of it. And there the people were talking among themselves, acknowledging that the mercury caused the autism. And one of the people there said, boy, my grandchildren are never going to get this vaccine. That's for sure, mercury in their vaccines. And yet, of course, they covered this up to let other people's children get the vaccine.
Yeah, it's terrible, and I get emotional just like you do. I keep thinking that one day I'll get up in the morning and I'll hear that it's all over, and it's not all over, unfortunately. It's continuing, and without continuing pressure, and there's lots of pressure, by the way. There's not just the vaccine court. There's 7 states have already outlawed thimerosal, although they don't enforce it very well. We're working with the governor of Florida now, Governor Crist, to outlaw it in Florida. There's movements in the U.S. Congress to outlaw it. There's movements in various courts to get it, taken out of our vaccines. There are, last summer there were 10,000 parents marching in the streets of Washington. They've marched at the CDC.
No, because
it's a major problem that is not going to go away anytime soon.
But, of course, we never hear about the 10,000 parents marching in Washington, D.C., because they control the media, and they're not going to let us know what's really going on, other than they come out with a report that we can assure the public that that the vaccines do not produce autism.
Yeah, they control the media. It's interesting. It's sort of like a chess game, and each side has an advantage. They control the media. Our side pretty much controls the parents. They control the pediatricians. And quite surprisingly to people, we control the publications. I don't mean we control it, but they do not control the peer-reviewed publications, and most major universities have published on our side. There are hundreds, thousands of articles on our side that they can't control. So what they do about it, they have two big lies they like to tell you. The first lie is that thimerosal is all out of the vaccines and it's been out since 2001. And that's an outright lie. Anybody can pick up a flu vaccine and see that it has full dose thimerosal. And the other lie they tell you is there are no peer-reviewed studies on our side. And that can be confirmed by anybody who simply goes to the PubMed site of National Library of Medicine and types in thimerosal. I mean, we get up every morning and we look at what came out overnight, and it's an exciting morning because almost every day there's another article, either an animal model, a human model, an epidemiological model from Harvard, from you know, University of Kentucky, from Calgary, from almost every major university in this country that has supported us. So they're absolutely lying about that. The truth of the matter is they have a handful of studies on their side. What they have is their idea of a study is three guys get together and they say it doesn't cause. What I mean is a study is somebody who actually did a study, either on animals or tissue culture or people or whatever, and, you know, got a peer-reviewed result. And in that, they're outnumbered 100-1. So they're losing in that, and they don't know how to stop it. They try to stop it. They go after the people, you know, the university, don't have them publish that anymore, but they really can't stop it. So it's an interesting kind of thing, and ultimately, it has to collapse because the ultimate thing that will happen is these kids will come out of school, and we won't know what to do with them. And people are going to just go, you know, and it's starting to happen already. There aren't even places in the institution if you wanted to put them in the institution. It's an overwhelming, horrible thing that's happening to our country. And meanwhile, as I said, in addition to being whistleblowers, which we understand that whistleblowers are very rarely appreciated, so they attack us. That's okay. But interestingly enough, because we have a therapy, we're doing something about it. They're still arguing about what causes it, and we are having amazing success in treating it all over the country. It's like a disconnect. I feel like, you know, the guy that invented penicillin, Fleming, he's curing people that have infectious disease with his penicillin, and they're still arguing whether bacteria causes infectious disease. That's the way I feel like it. We know what causes it. We have it worked out. We've published it all over the place in many, many different journals. And now we have a therapy, and we're supplying it everywhere. And they're still arguing whether there's an autism epidemic, which is, you know, patently absurd. Any of your listeners can tell you don't even need a scientific study. Nobody ever saw an autistic when we were young, you know, in the 70s and 80s. Now, if you go to McDonald's or you go to Target or you go to a store, you'll run into four of them because they're everywhere. You go down the street and your neighbors have them. I mean, there's no epidemic. I mean, maybe they don't say there's no epidemic. They're not sure. You know, it's amazing that they're not sure. It's the most overwhelming epidemic in the history of the world, but they're not sure. Well, it's not an infectious disease epidemic, and that's what they know about. This is a chronic disease epidemic, unfortunately, a very catastrophic one.
You know, what's happening in Africa? Do we have any idea there? Of course, Bill Gates. The Bill Gates Foundation is giving this poison to the children over there, because you have to understand, Bill Gates is one of these people who's in favor of population control. So why would that he be trying to save the lives of these little black children? What's happening with autism in Africa?
It's going crazy. And they don't make any bones about it. They give thimerosal containing in every one of their vaccines. And the levels are very, very high, and the Africans are very, very nervous. And interestingly enough, the United Methodists run a lot of the units in Africa. And that's one of the reasons you and your readers need to read this book. Because the book is a fascinating book. It's not a how-to book, and it's not a book on, you know, telling what's wrong with autism. It's the adventures of Reverend Lisa Sykes. And Reverend Lisa Sykes, at first you might say, well, why would you want to read her adventures? But it turns out she's a very interesting person in this. She's a mom who's a reverend in the United Methodist Church whose child was damaged. Her child turned out to be the very first one that was ever treated. But beyond that, she's gone around and she's gotten the United Methodist Church worldwide to condemn this and to make this their number one priority. And they're now threatening to not give the vaccines in Africa if they don't remove the thimerosal.
So she's a very influential person, and she tells the story of how she went to Congress, how she went to these meetings, and how she found out that they were lying, and she documents the whole thing, how she met us, how she sort of, we had the theory of how to treat this, but we hadn't done it, how she convinced us to try it on her son first, and how, you know, she then saw the great improvement and has gone around becoming a major campaigner in this, how she tried to get it stopped in the courts. It's really a compelling story written by someone who's really quite a nice writer with an interesting religious bent. You know, she for example, she takes apart Simpsonwood line by line, and then she counters them with biblical lines. You know, like when they say it's secret, she says that the Bible tells us that those who would keep, you know, evil secrets will be, the secret will be shouted from the highest, you know, churches, whatever. She has all these quotations. It's really, really a fascinating book. And if you want to know about what happened and how it happened, and the only thing about the book is that you have to see the ending because it hasn't happened yet. We don't know how it turns out. We don't know whether, in the end, evil will win out or good will win out. In other words, there may have to be a second installment where the adventures end up with, hopefully, removal of thimerosal, the treatment of the children, and some justice. But that still remains in the air.
Well, I really believe that the people in the vaccine companies, the people working in government, should be held before the bar of judges, of justice, and they should be imprisoned for their crimes against a whole generation of children. Well, nothing the Nazis did was ever as horrible as this,
well,
to destroy the minds of the children intentionally.
The book has an interesting piece, which is that when the U.S. government held hearings on this for 3.5 years, the Government Reform Committee, which is one of the ways I got so involved, is David and I were working with that committee, and the committee eventually found, by the way, that thimerosal and the vaccines caused the epidemic, and the our government health officials were guilty of institutional malfeasance. The lawyer for that, the chief counsel for that committee, who actually has died since, left us with a list of indictments on who should be indicted and what they should be charged with, and that is in the book. And it wasn't written by Lisa Sykes; it was written by the chief counsel for the U.S. Congress.
Well, now, how did Lisa's son actually do?
He's done amazingly well. She convinced me to actually try it on him because when we met him, he was like 8-something years old, and he had the usual history of the autistics that we see, which is he was perfectly normal till about 18 months. And from that time, he had a terrible regression. And when I saw him, he had no words. He had chronic diarrhea, which could not be treated. And what really persuaded me, she invited me to her home to see him. I gave him a candy, and he couldn't put it in his mouth. You know, a one-year-old can put a candy in their mouth. He's missing his mouth. He was bumping into walls. He would fall down the stairs. This is an 8-year-old. So, she convinced me that his life couldn't go on that way anymore. Now, his name is Wesley, and I'm allowed to use his name, Wesley Sykes, and you can read about him. In fact, his picture is on the cover of the book. And Sacred Spark, actually, the name means that, you know, he had a spark from, you know, a spark of personality, a spark of being normal, and then he lost it, and now how he got it back. And that's why it's called Sacred Spark. But now, he reads Harry Potter. He can type in a computer. I had him type. He types very well. In fact, he types with a southern accent. He speaks, but he doesn't speak all the time. And he types, you know what I mean by southern accent? He'll type, "Good morning, y'all," which is really cute because a northerner wouldn't type that. So, and you can ask him who his favorite artist is, and he'll tell you, what kind of music they have. So I said, "Wesley, type me why you don't speak." And he typed back with perfect spelling and everything. I try to, but sometimes the words don't come out. So he's tremendously improved. He goes with his brothers. He plays games with his brothers. He can catch a ball. He goes to school. He can swing. He can sometimes say some words. Tremendously improved. Not normal, but tremendously improved. And we thought, when we first saw him, that must be really lucky, the greatest improvement. But we see this, he's sort of average. We see this all the time. The hardest thing to come back is speech. Some of our kids get it all back. He's gotten some of it back. He hugs his mother. He lets you hold his hand. These things may seem like small things to you, but he wouldn't allow himself to be touched by anybody. And now he can hug. He can live. He has a life. I don't think he'll ever be normal, but he has a life. We gave him a life back.
Well, now, what about a child who's, say 14 or 15? Can you help them at all?
Yes, we've helped children or people as old as in the 20s. In the 20s, very often they're in institutions, and we've gotten a number of them out. But we make them, the first thing we make them is, the biggest problem in the teenage years very often is aggression. A little kid, you know, smacks you because he's autistic.
Well, he smacks you hard because he has testosterone. They're stronger than you think. But, you know, you can probably tolerate that. When they're 16 and they're 6'2" and they weigh 200 pounds, they smack the mom and the mom ends up in the hospital. So the first thing we try to do is make the teenagers safe. And then we try to bring them back to being more and more normal. And how much normal you can bring back depends. As people have pointed out, they used to think that all the autistics were mentally retarded. And that's not true. It's true that they probably don't do well on IQ tests because they can't take IQ tests. But if you make their autism better, some of them are mentally retarded, but most of them aren't. And if they have brain damage from the mercury, obviously we don't know how to restore that. But if they just have hormonal component, then it'll come back. I had a little girl that was terribly autistic, and she wasn't in regular school. And now she comes in, and she's one of these that hugs everybody, says, "Hi, doctor, hi, everybody." And she's in, first they put her in second grade with a shadow, someone to help her individually. Then they took away the shadow. And now she's in normal school. Now they had a spelling bee for the whole school. She won.
Hold that thought, and we'll be right back. Well, the guest, of course, is Dr. Mark Geyer, his son David. What about the issue of multiple vaccines given at one time? Certainly the fact that many times they'll give them.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
With food prices soaring to all-time highs, as the dollar continues to fall in value, what can you and your family do to guarantee that fresh, nutritious vegetables will make it to your dinner table? Garden in a Can. Garden in a Can is your source for premium, long-term storable seeds. Garden in a Can is ready when you are. Plant them now or store them for when you really need them. There are 16 large, hermetically sealed, non-hybrid, open-pollinated packets of seeds, along with detailed planting instructions sealed in a can for ultimate long-term protection. Garden in a Can. It's that simple. Fresh. Healthy. Easy. Only $69.95 for over a half acre of safe, fresh vegetables. Ready when you are. Stop procrastinating and start preparing with Garden in a Can. For more details, visit GardenInACan.com today. That's GardenInACan.com or call 866-598-7396, 866-598-7396.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us.
This is so important, I wanted you to hear it. Understand that there are evil and wicked people out there who want to harm our children, and they're doing a great job of it, and you're going to have to help us educate your doctor. We have a wonderful DVD, and if you get it, you get it, a CD-ROM with literally thousands of pages of government documents on this subject, which you can print out and take to your doctor. It's called Mercury Autism and the Global Population Epidemic. Mercury autism and the population control agenda. Mercury autism and the population control agenda, given by Dr. Ayub a couple of years ago at our conference. You need to get this. You need to understand. There really are wicked people out there. We have a 4-tape set on Mercury. We've got 3 or 4 DVDs on Mercury. We carry the book, one book on Mercury. The title escaped me right now, but I'm sure we'll be carrying this other book, this one on the sacred spark. Because, ladies and gentlemen, these children, each one is a unique individual made in the image and likeness of God. And there are people working at the highest levels of our government who are poisoning them. The Congressional Committee investigated all of this, brought it out, and totally blocked out by the media. Your job is to get the information and help us get it out. And, of course, if you'd like to get certainly Dr. Ayub's DVD, along with the CD-ROM, comes at no additional cost, and you'll get thousands of pages of scientific studies. And then, of course, we have 2 4-tape sets, as I remember, and then we've got a couple of DVDs going into the back of this, going into the background of the mercury and the terrible problems from mercury that are destroying the minds of our children. And then, of course, this is intimately involved with Alzheimer's disease, aluminum and mercury and fluoride. And we have a 4-tape set on Alzheimer's disease. And you must understand that they're encouraging Alzheimer's. Why? Because the elderly certainly are not productive anymore. They're bankrupting Medicare, and they're just going to have to, they'd be far better off without them, wouldn't they? Well, the trouble is, I'm 80 years old, and I fit into that category as well. They know what's producing these things. You need to get our 4-tape set on Alzheimer's disease. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. They're poisoning our children with fluoride. We have 2 excellent 4-tape sets on water fluoridation. We have a number of DVDs on it. Dr. Kennedy put those out. And one of them you'll actually see a professor up in Toronto, a professor of dentistry up there, preventive dentistry. And I actually interviewed him one time, asked him to come on my program. He told me, he said, I've been threatened. I really am not willing to risk my family and my profession just to be on your program. But of course, you'll actually see these DVDs of his being interviewed before he was threatened. And of course, we have the book on fluoridation. All of this is available from Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-544-8927. For the best overview I can think of on water fluoridation, a talk, well, it's my talk, on the hidden agenda and the syllabus that goes with that. You'll get all the scientific studies that you need. And if your dentist isn't at least been open-minded, why, he will realize he's pushing the wrong ideas. And if he's not, I'd just find a dentist who would do the right thing, who's not going to be putting in the mercury fillings and harming you and your children. And a dentist who refuses at least to look at the data, if not a man you want to be going to. And there really are a lot of dentists out there who recognize the problems. Maybe they're not going to become crusaders, but they're not going to be putting the mercury fillings. And they're not going to be, of course, recommending water fluoridation. But, of course, the worst thing at all, we need to get the pediatricians, because most of them are good people. But, of course, the danger of the vaccines. We actually have the books. Vaccines, are they safe and effective? That's vaccines, are they safe and effective? The book on autism, both by Neil Miller and, of course, his large book, The Vaccine Safety Manual. Give us a call, get the material, help us save the lives of children. Hale. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and of course they're the views of our guest. And for the next hour, our guest will be William Grigg, former senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now, of course, suddenly writing his blog and writing books and of course, getting information out across America, and fortunately, a regular guest here at Radio Liberty. William, thank you so very much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, thank you once again for the opportunity.
Boy, we are certainly living in exciting times, you know. We see that,
yes.
Certainly, Mr. Obama, President Obama, has put forward a bill that's supposed to solve all of our problems, you know, the stimulus bill. And the stock market keeps dropping and dropping. He says, you know, it's going to be catastrophic. If you don't give me this money, things are going to get terrible. And we gave him the money, and things are getting terrible.
Yeah, that is the one constant in the equation, is that things will get worse. They have to get worse. That's the nature of economics. If you've overbuilt, overspent, overborrowed, then in order to reach equilibrium, things have to be at least as bad as they were apparently buzzing during the boom. But unfortunately, people have come to the conclusion that we can achieve weightlessness, that there is some kind of an exception for every generation presently alive from the rules that govern economics, that people can spend and borrow their way to prosperity as opposed to working and saving their way to prosperity. It really is not difficult to understand. There are certain ineluctable realities. You talk about dispelling delusions. Here's a durable one. People believe themselves to be immune to or exempt from the ineluctable realities of the economy. You have to be able to produce in order to prosper. You have to be able to save in order to produce, in order to capitalize your efforts to produce. And in order to save and produce and have a reliable economy, you have to have some kind of reliable currency. And the best kind of currency, of course, would be gold or silver, something that has established, settled value, that is divisible and portable, that is scarce, and that has an intrinsic value, or what is considered to be an intrinsic value. And of course, if you ignore these big, important rules, then you end up with some very bad problems of the sort we're having right now, but they're of an unprecedented magnitude. Every time I talk with somebody in a thrift store or a grocery store, a convenience store, a gas station, about what's going on in the economy, I'm amazed by a couple of things. The first of which is that your common run of American citizens seems to be much better informed and much more instinctively sound in his or her assessment of what's going on with the economy than the so-called experts who harangue us from the television and the radio.
I know. I think that really is so true,
yes.
Especially the people who've got a college degree, and I happen to have a college degree. And I'll never forget when I first started hearing about what was going on. I just couldn't believe it was true because I had a college degree, and I had a Phi Beta Kappa Key, and I had honors and honor societies, and how could these things be true, and I'd never heard of them. Oh, what a humbling experience was to realize I'd been educated far beyond my intelligence. And that's the big problem with the intellectuals today. They really have no common sense, and I'll take a truck driver any time to somebody
yeah.
with a PhD in economics.
Yeah, especially if you're talking about somebody who's gone to a prestige university as opposed to your common land-grant college or even your common community college. People of that sort of had to work. They've had to be successfully somewhat in the private sector in terms of holding a job or maintaining a business, and that, of course, teaches you things that you can't learn in the sterile theoretical environment of a college classroom. The second astonishing thing I find out is how many of the people who instinctively know what's going on in the economy have been beguiled into making exactly the same mistakes that have always doomed economies previously to periods of contraction, recession, and depression. We always let hope, often irrational hope.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg here at Radio Liberty. William, go right ahead.
Yes. I was saying that we often let irrational hope shout down the more sober voice of experience, and That includes many of us who have a better and sounder understanding of how economics is supposed to work. I've made my share of mistakes, and probably somebody else's as well, but I'm amazed once again to find out how many people who can tell you what's wrong with the economy in a really rational way have found themselves in very serious trouble because they were lured into taking on bigger mortgages than they could afford, taking on more consumer debt than they could rationally afford in terms of credit cards, bought a bigger car or more cars than they really needed. There's just no substitute, really, for deferral of gratification and industry and thrift in order to achieve genuine prosperity. Of course, good fortune plays a role as well, but it's interesting how good fortune seems to attend people who do the former. And it's really interesting as well to think of how many people still believe, or at least profess to believe, that in order to cure the problems that we have found ourselves in, all we need is a larger and more energetic dose of the same approach that got us into trouble. And that, of course, is what's being preached by the Obama administration and its congressional allies, and many Republicans as well, or at least partway at home, or partway comfortable with this very durable piece of self-delusion. Many of the Republican congressmen and many of the Republican governors who oppose the so-called stimulus bill, and it's not a stimulus bill, it's just conventional pork barrel spending, albeit of a much larger magnitude, several orders of magnitude greater than we're accustomed to. It has nothing to do with stimulus, it's just simply pork and perks and payouts. But many of the Republican politicians who oppose the stimulus bill are now trying to find some way of taking political credit for it when it comes to ladling out the pork in their districts. And here in Idaho, we're having a controversy because Governor Butch Otter, a man I know slightly, I was at a youth camp where he was a lecturer back in 2000, and so I got to know him somewhat. Very nice man, very charismatic. He's got a pretty good head for economics and a pretty good knowledge of the Constitution. That being said, he does, as a congressman, he did allow himself to be swayed by partisan considerations into violating the constitutional oath he swore. And as governor, he's not been particularly faithful to the principles of limited government and sound economics. But he's been discussing the best ways to spend the stimulus money, so-called stimulus money, that he had opposed. He's been talking about how philosophically he is opposed to receiving it. Well, Governor Jindal down in Louisiana...
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll be right back here. Well, go right ahead.
Bobby Jindal, the very young, I believe he's, what, 34, 35? Very young Republican governor of Louisiana just announced that his government will not be receiving $90 million in so-called stimulus money. I don't know if that means that he's not going to receive the entire package, but the fact that he's turning it back says something commendable. He understands that there are strings attached to it, that with the receipt of federal money comes federal control, and he's at least being somewhat faithful to the Republican, what used to be the small-R Republican gospel of federalism and limited government, and at least trying to hold back the metastasizing growth of the welfare state. So I have to give kudos to Governor Jindal, at least limited, qualified kudos to Governor Jindal in Louisiana, while saying that Governor Otter here in Idaho has been less faithful to that same set of professed principles. And you've got Republican congressmen and senators who voted against that measure now hustling off to their districts to try to put themselves in front of the camera as the checks arrive. And that's how this system of mutual plunder has always worked. People, as Bastiat said 150, 160 years ago, are always trying to live at each other's expense by way of the state. And at some point, the system simply breaks down, and we're at that point right now. This is the terminal crisis, the welfare, warfare, fiat money state. We're not going to see this system survive. I don't know how much longer it's going to manage to protract its existence, but the sickness is into its bones, and I don't see how, given the simple volume of commitments that the government has undertaken, the generational commitments, the actual assumed financial liabilities of the government right now are over $60 trillion. That's larger than the global gross domestic product. The product of all the world's economies combined right now could not pay off those obligations. And we're in a period of financial and economic contraction that is not going to end very soon.
And I think it's important for people really to have some grasp of the fact that, in all probability, the federal debt this coming year, in 2009 we're in, is going to be about $2 trillion. They will acknowledge $1.2 trillion,
yeah.
But that doesn't take into account the almost $800 billion that, of course, in the stimulus bill. That doesn't take into account
yeah.
that they're talking about another $275 billion that they're going to use for the bailout of housing. And then they're talking about another $3 trillion, that's T, terrible trillion dollars, to bail out the banks. And nobody ever asked, where is this money coming from?
Yeah.
And of course, what's happening, of course, they're printing the money. We're not able to borrow this money from other places. And this is why today the price of gold was over $1,000. I think it backed off to $999.95, something like that. But you're going to find out, of course, that all throughout the entire world, people who understand economics and finance realize that they're going to destroy the value of the currency of the American dollar and every other currency in the world. And, of course, you have only one protection, and that is in gold. And, of course, the people who don't understand that are going to end up impoverished and losing everything. But go right ahead.
Yeah, one of the reasons that I have been, since 2005, when I could first afford it and considered it to be a present and pressing necessity, been buying precious metals, is not because I want to make myself rich through speculation, although if we take a look at the performance of both gold and silver, since 2005, if you had been an investor and had plunged a great deal of money into gold and silver in 2005, right now you would be doing very, very well. Silver has appreciated over 100% since 2005, and gold has gone up, not nearly that dramatically, but when I first started buying gold, it was under $700 an ounce. And, of course, there are fluctuations. There's particularly a great deal of dynamic fluctuation in the price of silver. But the reason why I did this was not because I intended to get rich. It was because I wanted to have something to hold on to by way of a fiscal anchor in the event that we found ourselves in a full-orbed currency crisis or banking meltdown. We had to have something that I was sure would, first of all, be under my control, that would appreciate rather than depreciating as dollar-based assets always do, and that thirdly, would in an extraordinary crisis, a civilizational crisis, if you will, be accepted as currency in exchange for something that we really needed. There's no substitute for actually having the commodities that you need. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to have gold and silver. It's also very important, as I said before, to invest in the third of the noble metals, and that is lead. Lead in the form of ammunition, unfortunately. By way of illustrating why that last is important, here in this small town that we live in, which is a community of about 7,000 people, hard against the Snake River, the western boundary of Oregon, or the eastern, or forgive me, the western boundary of Idaho, or the eastern boundary of Oregon. Just a couple of nights ago, in the middle of the night, a gang of no doubt slope-browed, knuckle-dragging, cretinous miscreants went into the community park here and helped themselves to a Civil War cannon that was part of a community display. We have a small display that has been here, I'm guessing, for the better part of a century or longer. And, of course, there was a small cannon that was an artifact that was of value to people who donated it here to the city. And they stole this cannon for the purpose of melting it down and selling the iron, obviously. But they did this simply because they found it a more attractive option than actually going out and earning money the old-fashioned way. In the last month or so here in, not in Payette, but in the town right across the river in the Oregon border, Ontario, there have been three or four bank robberies. There have been armed robberies at retail stores, including a clothing store that my wife shops at. There have been various strong-arm robberies at Walmart. I was actually on the scene about a month and a half ago in Caldwell, while a bank robbery was in progress across from a Walmart in that small community. I actually was trying to get out of the parking lot, and the police had all the exits covered, and one of them came up and knocked on my window and told me that there was a bank robbery in progress. Sort of ironic that people would be trying to steal money from a bank. All the banks are broke anyway. But the fact is that they still have something that is exchangeable as money, that is circulatable as money. And so people are doing this as a, first of all, as a, because it's something that presents itself as an opportunity, but also because people are growing more desperate. The times are getting harder.
people are getting rougher. And if you have something of value, whether it's, of course, gold or silver, or whether it's food, or whether it's something that can be pawned and sold for food, you have to start thinking in terms of protecting that asset for you and your family. And there's no substitute for having the actual commodities, once again, and for actually having some physical possession of precious metals. But bear in mind that the times are starting to get coarser and rougher than they've been in quite some time, and the trajectory is very steep, and our acceleration gradient is very, very dramatic. And I really do believe that within the next several months, we're going to start finding ourselves astonished at just how much latent violence there has been pent up in this culture that has been covered up for many, many decades by the cushion of fiat money and easy living through loose money and easy credit. And once, of course, that cushion's removed and the fall becomes very rough, we're going to find ourselves aching and I think quite scared over what we're going to see.
And I think it's very interesting. You know, I live in California, and the courts in their wisdom have said you've got to start releasing prisoners.
Yeah.
You know, 50,000, 75,000 prisoners. I mean, some of them may be violent prisoners, but oh my goodness, they're not getting adequate health care. They're being deprived of their civil rights. You've got to start releasing criminals, prisoners from the prison so that they won't be so crowded. Now, what do you think happens when we release a lot of prisoners into the community? Of course, you saw this, what happened over in Iran. You saw this when they demanded all the political prisoners be released under the Shah of Iran, and pretty soon you had riots and the total breakdown of society. Why, at this time in history, would they suddenly demand massive prisoner releases in California? Doesn't make sense from a logical point of view.
Yeah, well, we're dealing with the a period of history and with the ruling elite that tend to be somewhat immune to the seductions of logic. I mean, often these decisions are made in what appears to be a logic-free zone, but then again, there is a sinister logic at work here if you understand that there are people who have a vested interest in social turmoil, because every time you generate social turmoil, you generate a demand for the control of the turmoil. And so one of the illustrations that I used just this week in my blog had to do with the city of Chicago. In 1993, in Chicago, there was a gang summit. Now, people are used to hearing the term gang summit in reference to meetings of law enforcement agencies and regulatory bodies and civic officials to deal with the problem of armed gangs. Well, no, this is a summit composed of gang leaders, people from the Bloods, the Crips, people from the Latin Kings, the various so-called nations of the streets. They had a big summit in Chicago. They received an address by Jesse Jackson, and they also received a videotape message from Bill Clinton, who at the time was the president. This was an urban policy meeting, according to the estimable Reverend Jackson. These are people, of course, who were involved in day-to-day criminal offenses. That is their livelihood. The livelihood consists of using violence and the threat of violence in order to commit crimes against persons and property. And, of course, there's a natural affinity between that type of armed gang and the type of armed gang that calls itself a government. And so there's always this unspoken entente between street gangs and the official gang we call the government, and their common enemy would be the law-abiding population, those of us who simply want to maintain our property, maintain the dignity of our personal freedom, the dignity of our person, meaning it was the physical individual that each of us is. And those of us who want to retain the wealth that we earn legitimately and perhaps transmit it to our heirs, we are in the gunfights of that entente. And what you're describing in California is a pretty classic example of that. Once again, to advert to Bastiat, that's a case of creating the poison and the antidote in the same laboratory, I think.
Well, I think that we're in real trouble. I think we're going to be moving into a period of chaos and crisis in America. And people say that couldn't happen here. Oh, so the stimulus bill is going to help, you know. The new housing bailout is going to help. You know, the new $2 or $3 trillion that they're going to put out to stabilize the banks are going to help. Ladies and gentlemen, the structure of society is breaking down all throughout the world. The chaos in Eastern Europe, there's chaos in Russia, they're devaluing the currency. Other demonstrations, massive demonstrations in Greece and certainly in Spain. And of course, you think we're going to be immune here? We created the whole situation.
Oh boy.
Go right ahead, William.
Yeah, when you talk about what's happening in Russia right now, you might as well bring up the fact that it's not just Russia. I mean, we started with Iceland about 4 months ago. And what happened in Iceland, of course, has propagated itself. Iceland has had a change in government. They brought to power the first openly homosexual head of state, which I find an interesting little turn of events. Iceland is a country of roughly 400,000 people. It has a population, I think, roughly the size of Vermont. And they had a complete financial meltdown. It only took them 6 or 8 months for the currency to become exactly worthless and to become non-transmissible beyond the borders of their country. And that, of course, put them in a bad situation, as we pointed out before, because they import practically everything. They're an island nation that doesn't really produce a whole lot. They used to be involved very heavily in fishing. They really had to get back into that business, but they decided to get involved in exotic offshore finance capitalism. They were, of course, one of the first national victims of this meltdown. I've read a great deal of reportage about what's gone on with their street protests. Most of their street protests have been very genteel and well-organized and peaceful. But, of course, they've had people show up, many of them American, for the purpose of trying to radicalize these protests and make them more violent. And to the considerable credit of the Icelanders, they didn't bite on the bait. But there are people who are ready to take advantage of turmoil, such as we've seen unfold in countries such as, we mentioned Russia, Greece. Hungary has had a really rough time of it recently. Just about any member state of the European Union, the euro, according to the whole eurozone banking system, according to a piece that was briefly on the London Telegraph's website, has been taken off and rewritten within about an hour and a half. Gary North, Dr. Gary North, had an article about that this week. The entire eurozone banking system is literally on the verge of complete insolvency. And when that happens, of course, you're going to see the type of riots that have unfolded in places like Iceland and in France. There have been some riots again. They're going to sweep in a wave across the entire continent, but they're going to be nowhere near as contained or genteel. And I don't doubt for a second that there are going to be people who are going to be insinuated into these riots for the purpose of making them more violent, making them more ostentatiously radical, and moving them in a certain direction. It's a very easy thing once people have surrendered their individual discretion into a mob to take control of that mob and lead it in a certain direction.
And I think it's really so important. This is a standard technique that is used by the establishment, but we have a great four-tape set. It's called The Battle in Seattle, and it goes into the background of the demonstrations held there against the, I think it was of the World Financial Organization of some sort. I've forgotten which
World
one.
World Trade Organization.
World Trade Organization. But if you, certainly we interview people who are actually there. It was all planned. They brought in their professional agitators. They encouraged the people to come in. The mayor held a big party for all the people coming in there to demonstrate there the night before, big party with all sorts of entertainment. Then they got the people on the streets, the professional agitators were there, starting fires, breaking windows, they were all dressed in ninja suits, and then of course once things got out of hand, then they all disappeared and the people were there, pitted against the police, who were using their clubs and using their tear gas, and the people of course then reacted, and it was all planned, it was all staged, and the plea that I have to our listeners is do not fall into that trap. That's exactly what they want, because that's the justification for martial law, and that's just exactly why they bring the troops home from Iraq. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is William Grigg, and we're just talking about how they are planning on creating civil unrest in this country. They're planning on infiltrating the conservative movement or the liberal movement, who is ever out there demonstrating, and trying to promote violence so that they can justify martial law. They know exactly what they're doing. They're following a master plan. Don't fall into their trap. Go right ahead.
It was the inherited wisdom of anti-war protesters in the 1960s, and by anti-war protesters, I'm not talking about the people who were burning things and destroying property and attacking people in the streets. I'm talking about people who are well-dressed and generally dignified and well-behaved, libertarian sorts, and some people on the left who simply opposed the Vietnam War out of principle. It was their inherited wisdom that the person who showed up and started talking about setting things on fire and blowing things up was a federal informant. And the same inherited wisdom was shared by people of less commendable points of view, such as the Ku Klux Klan. It was just understood that if somebody showed up and said, let's go out and burn things and kill people, he almost certainly was in the pay of the federal government, the FBI, or some of the three-letter agency. Well, here's a really good example of how that works. Just in the last, I think, 36 hours, there was an indictment handed down in Minnesota against the so-called RNC-8. And the RNC-8 were part of an admittedly radicalized left-wing group called the Republican the Welcoming Committee. And they had planned for over a year to have protests attended to the Republican National Convention in St. Paul. And during the same period of time, the Sheriff's Department there in Minneapolis-St. Paul was liaising with the local FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force and the Department of Homeland Security to create a countervailing movement to neutralize the Welcoming Committee. Now, if you understand that there are elements of this movement, these are many of the same people who were involved in the WTO protests of 1999 and various other protests since then. But within this group, there are a lot of misguided, naive, but idealistic people who are opposed to the war in Iraq, who are opposed to the assault on civil liberties in this country, the Patriot Act, Patriot Act II. They were opposed to the destruction of habeas corpus. In other words, they share many of the same concerns that libertarian and conservative people who appreciate our Constitution would certainly understand. But the RNC-8 were charged with conspiracy to commit terrorism. None of these people threw a Molotov cocktail. None of these people in any way attacked persons or property. None of them committed any acts of violence or vandalism for political purposes. And if, by the way, you commit an act of vandalism, that's not an act of terrorism. If you commit an act of property destruction, that's not an act of terrorism. But what they're saying is that any of these things that were done for political purposes should be construed as terrorism as opposed to vandalism or aggravated property destruction or aggravated assault or what have you, because the state equivalent of the Patriot Act permits them to be described as terrorism because there's a political subtext. These people, it has never been demonstrated, had anything to do that with any of these acts of violence or vandalism, but they're charged with conspiracy to commit terrorism, and the chief witness against them is an individual 30-year-old man by the name of Andrew C. Darst. Now, he showed up about a year or so ago, just as this group was getting going with its planning, and provided them with all kinds of detailed maps and detailed help and very helpful suggestions as to how to plan their activities. He was somebody who's working with the FBI. Well, he's somebody who's a recidivist criminal. And just in the last several weeks, he was arrested and charged with assault and burglary and breaking into the home of a friend who was having a party. His wife was there. He was upset that his wife was attending the party. I don't know the specifics of the domestic situation. What I do know is that according to the Star Tribune, Mr. Darst says, you spied on anarchists planning disruptions at the Republican National Convention in September. He attended an Hennepin County District Court hearing on Tuesday for a January 11th incident in, I believe it's pronounced, Minnetrista, in which he allegedly broke into a house and struck two men. He is charged with two felony counts of first and second degree burglary, as well as fifth degree assault and misdemeanor. Darst was involved in the Welcoming Committee's Action Faction, which discussed plans for street disruptions. Other group members have said he had more access to internal plans than three undercover operatives to the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. So they're charging these people who did nothing to injure people or to destroy property with terrorism because they were part of a group that was staging political street protests. But at the same time, their chief witness is somebody who's actually out committing acts of assault and violence and property destruction.
Well, I would tell you, they have the conservative movement fairly well infiltrated.
Oh, sure.
I'll never forget, of course, one time when I was actually approached and on camera, this one fellow, I had always rather trusted him, and he suddenly says to me, well, of course, we're not going to get out of this without resorting to violence, are we, Stan? I looked at him and I said, you know, to myself, this guy's obviously a CIA plant or an FBI plant or a government plant of some sort. Could you imagine what would have happened if I'd agreed with him on television? Why, of course, I'd probably be in prison today. They have planted people all throughout our society. And ladies and gentlemen, be very careful when somebody starts suggesting you get involved in violent protests of one sort or another or violating the law or taking up arms against the government. Be careful. this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is certainly William Grigg. And William, go right ahead, pick up the story.
Well, we were talking a lot about the logic and the dangers of violent street-level radicalism. It's interesting that Zbigniew Brzezinski, I believe it was today, on the CNBC program with Joe Scarborough, was talking about the possibility of what he called class conflict. And this is what Brzezinski said. By the way, Brzezinski's daughter, Mika, is one of the regular co-hosts of that program. So Zbigniew Brzezinski, the co-founder of the Trilateral Commission, is on this program quite frequently. But he says the following: I was worrying about the possibility of class conflict because we're going to have millions and millions of unemployed people really facing dire straits. We're going to be having that for some period of time before things hopefully improve. And at the same time, there is public awareness of this extraordinary wealth that was transferred to a few individuals at levels without historical precedent in America. And you sort of say to yourself, what's going to happen in this society when these people are without jobs, when their families hurt, when they lose their homes and so forth? We have the government trying to repair the banking system to bail the housing out, but what about the rich guys? Where is it? What are they doing? It sort of struck me that in 1907, when we had a massive banking crisis, when banks were beginning to collapse, there were going to be riots in the streets. Some financiers led by J.P. Morgan got together. He locked them in his library at one point. He wouldn't let them out until 4:45 a.m., until they all kicked in and gave some money to stabilize the banks. There was no Federal Reserve at the time. Where is the moneyed class today? Why aren't they doing something? The people who made billions, millions, I'm sort of thinking of Paulson, of Rubin, why don't they get together and why don't they organize a national solidarity fund in which they call on those who made extraordinary amounts of money to kick some back into a national solidarity fund? And if we don't get some kind of voluntary national solidarity fund, at some point there'll be such political pressure that Congress will start getting in the act and there's going to be growing conflict between the classes and the people are unemployed and really hurting. Hell, there could even be riots. It's really interesting.
But William, could you send that to me?
I will.
Send that to me, because I think it's so vitally important for our listeners to understand that Zbigniew Brzezinski is part of this ruling elite,
sure,
that has made all of the money. Who's gotten all the money? Why, of course, our major banks. Banks like J.P. Morgan Chase, banks like Goldman Sachs, banks like Citicorp, at least two of the three are Rockefeller banks, and Mr. Brzezinski works for the Rockefellers. And, of course, they're all part and parcel of the Trilateral Commission. You can go to AugustReview.org, look at the membership list of the North American group of the Trilateral Commission, and Mr. Brzezinski organizes. This is obviously their plan. He's laying it right out for you. We're going to see civilian unrest, and that's exactly what, of course, they're going to have their agents aggravating absurdity lobbying for. We'll be right back. Yeah, this is Dr. Stan, and William is just telling us about a remark that was made on a television program recently by Zbigniew Brzezinski, talking about the coming civil unrest and how it is unfair that some wealthy people have made so much money during this crisis and the poor are losing so much. Mr. Brzezinski represents the wealthy people. He is part of the Trilateral Commission. He's part of the group that created this. He's working with the bankers and the people from the Fed who actually created this whole problem, and saying how terrible it is that these people have made all this money and so many are losing, and he's doing everything he can to actually create civil unrest and jealousy and, of course, hatred for those who have anything. And yet he is the very person who's been working as part of this cabal, and it is a cabal. And all you need to do is read what Barry Goldwater said back in 1979, talking about the Trilateral Commission, where he said this is international. Its purpose is to take over financial and commercial control by first seizing control of the government of the United States. By seizing control of the government of the United States, Chris, what happened? The Trilateral Commission, since 1976, either every president and or vice president has been a member of Mr. Brzezinski's little organization. See, how could that possibly have happened? By coincidence, at least 11 key members of the Obama campaign administration in key positions all come from the Council on Foreign Relations, and six of the last seven World Bank presidents came from the organization. Six of the last eight, World A trade organization representative came from this Trilateral Commission. There's only 87 members or members of, who are actually Americans. How could they have that many people in key positions? Well, of course, there is a cabal. They control America. But go right ahead, William.
Yeah, one of the most important things that Mr. Brzezinski was talking about here was the way that in 1907, when there was a financial panic going on, there was no Federal Reserve, that J.P. Morgan was trying to create some kind of an effort, supposedly voluntary effort, to recapitalize banks that were failing. But what Brzezinski doesn't talk about is the fact that this is a precursor to the creation later of this long-desired bankers' trust for the purpose of controlling the entire money supply, controlling the economy through the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve was sold to the public as a remedy for the type of collapse and panic that led to what happened in 1907 with the banks that were failing and the prospect of riots in the street, widespread social unrest, hunger, and destitution.
But nobody ever points out that this whole thing was precipitated
exactly.
by the major banks. And, of course, the banks of J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller were the major banks, the Mellons, the Whitneys, a few of the others. But the major banks precipitated that entire crisis. They did it intentionally and purposely to create a crisis just so they could take the farms and the homes and the businesses and the savings of the people of America. And then they used that as a justification, so that they could bring in the central bank, which, of course, precipitated the current contraction, and it's all done, but they can't let the American people realize that it's deja vu all over again at exactly the same family dynasties. Maybe the John D. Rockefeller and the J.P. Morgans are dead, but J.P. Morgan Chase Bank is the descendant of J.P. Morgan and a Chase Manhattan, a J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller Bank. It was David Rockefeller who was the president of the Chase Manhattan Bank for probably close to 20 years. But you go right ahead, William.
Yeah, what I'm thinking is that the equivalent of what Brzezinski is talking about here, this supposed humanitarian cabal put together, use that word cabal again, by J.P. Morgan in 1907, when Brzezinski talks about the equivalent of that today being some kind of a voluntary solidarity fund, I'm wondering if when the time comes for not the nationalization, now there's open discussion now of the nationalization of American banks, but the globalization of the banking system, the creation of a one-world central bank, one-world fiat currency, if somehow this is going to be sold to the public as some kind of a global solidarity fund. Already, of course, you see with Obama's proposal to meet the millennium goals here by by allocating this huge amount of money in foreign aid for the purpose of meeting the United Nations Millennium Fund objectives for, I can't remember what the specific percentage of our gross domestic product is going to be, but the idea is that we have to kick into this huge fund to relieve the poverty and the destitution spreading throughout the so-called developing world as a result of this global financial contraction. I wonder if at some point this year, next year, sometime before 2012, no doubt, if people of Brzezinski's kidney are going to announce the creation of some kind of grand solidarity initiative as a cover for the creation of the global equivalent of what happened with the Federal Reserve when it was unveiled after gestating at Jekyll Island. Just by way of trying to project on the basis of what Brzezinski was saying here, we're not just going to see riots in the streets of the United States, of course. We're already seeing riots overseas, but things are going to get much, much worse. And until there are riots in the streets of American cities, it's really not going to reach the crisis, that is. It's not going to reach the type of critical mass that would be useful to the creation of that type of an entity. So I do think that you're seeing a look at the playbook here. And as you said just before the last break, it's pretty clear that both sides, both the left and the right, have been very generously sown with provocateurs and agents in place, people who are prepared and very capable, very adept at irassing the masses, if you will, angering people and then getting in front of mobs and provoking them into doing things that are very much in keeping with the old dialectic of infiltrating an uprising, then cracking down on a society. I don't know if you're familiar with the fellow from New Jersey by the name of Hal Turner. He's somebody who had been a friend of Sean Hannity's and a regular caller on Sean Hannity's program. Mr. Turner used to have a television program that was simulcast on the Internet with the radio show. More recently, he's just been consigned to blogging. But he's somebody who has and continues to go out and try to provoke people into committing acts of violence. At one point, a couple of years ago, he had a hit list, a literal hit list of people in the Senate that he thought should be killed. And he's done the same thing now with the so-called stimulus package. These are people who need to be taken out, according to Mr. Turner. Well, he was exposed about a year and a half ago as somebody who is working hand-in-hand with the local FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. There was actually an email that was discovered where he had said to, I believe, a Mr. Hogg, who is the special agent in charge of that Joint Terrorism Task Force, that he was helping to flush out the crazies by saying what he said and writing what he wrote. And Mr. Turner has been very active, for instance, in promoting all kinds of penetrable nonsense about the North American Union, which, of course, is a viable threat. There is an effort to create a North American Union. Mr. Turner, on several occasions, has sent away to a company that makes these commemorative medallions that created a simulacrum of what an Amero coin would look like. And he's gone on YouTube and on various other file-sharing sites and said, here it is. I have in my hand an Amero coin that was minted at the Denver Mint, and here it is. You can see this is the actual currency. This is going to be replacing our currency by, and he'd give a date certain, and all those dates have passed, and that hasn't happened. And I and a number of other people have gone on the comment thread and said, well, Mr. Turner is misrepresenting what's going on. That is not an Amero coin. That is a medallion made by a company that specializes in making commemorative medallions and other artifacts of that sort. And the people who run that company are opposed to the North American Union. They're doing this by way of illustrating what it would look like. On their website, they're very candid about saying that. And here's Mr. Turner going in front of the public and trying to rile up the public with wild and inflammatory speeches and then trying to herd them in the direction of saying or acting out various fantasies of armed murderous violence against public officials, and the whole time he's in touch with the FBI.
Well, a lot of these people are actually being funded by the FBI, and we've run into this time and time again when they had the militia movement here in America that was thoroughly infiltrated by the FBI. In fact, the FBI was financing much of this, just as they financed the Communist Party here in the United States, and they financed the Ku Klux Klan. In fact, I know people who infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan for the FBI. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, they used to be said that, you know, went to a Communist Party meeting, the vast majority worked for one or another segment of intelligence organizations. We had certainly there in Oklahoma City, and there was a Christian Identity enclave there, Elohim City.
Yeah.
And most of the people there who were actually advocating violence, and they were training with automatic weapons and explosives, they all worked, everybody I know who was there, whether it be Andrea Strassmeyer, a young woman named, I believe,
Carol Howe.
Right, and then, of course,
Robert Millar.
He was the head of the organization. He was an FBI informant. He was bringing all these people in to train them in explosive use, and they were all working for one or another government agency. And when one government agency wanted to go in and shut them down before the attack on the Murrah building, why, of course, the Justice Department said, you can't go in there. But you're never going to hear this on regular radio, and you're sure not going to hear it from the so-called establishment conservatives who are so entertaining, and everybody just loves them. Go right ahead.
Yeah. Well, the thing about Elohim City that was really interesting, I had actually been keeping track of Elohim City before 9/11, because it struck me as such an odd little enclave, and afterwards, my former associate and good friend Bill Jasper, somebody you also know very well, Dr. Stan, discovered that there was this bright red line connecting Elohim City to what had happened in Oklahoma City and with the Murrah building bombing, and also with the so-called Aryan Republican Army, which was a gang of bank robbers who were conducting bank robberies throughout the country in order to finance this underground.
But of course, they were some of those were actually government agents as well.
Exactly. They were all being protected by the FBI, and Carol Howe had been desperately trying to contact somebody to interdict the bombing of the Murrah building, and her cover was blown, and then she was sent back in for the purpose of getting rid of her by her handlers there in the ATF. And that's the sort of thing that generally happens when you're talking about controlled operation of that kind. Here's another really good example.
Let me just make one other point about Carol Howe, because I have a wonderful interview with her lawyer, Chris. When they couldn't get her killed by the people in Elohim City, then they indicted her. They wanted to send her to prison.
Yeah.
What was the crime? Why, she was a patriot, and she was trying to uncover this terrorist activity. And I talked to her attorney. We have it, that interview in our Oklahoma City Update four-tape set. And they were going to send her to prison for the rest of her life just to silence her. Ladies and gentlemen, these things go on in America today. And they send innocent people to prison just to silence them. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you probably remember the 1983 Crossfire interview on the old CNN television debate program Crossfire, back in the days of Patty Cannon and Tom Brayden. Tom Brayden, of course, was a former CIA field operative. And there was an interview with, I believe, Larry McDonald, and it was revealed in the course of that interview that back when Tom Brayden was a CIA operative in the 1950s, he was the delivery boy in Europe who was disbursing funds to radical communist cells in Italy and some of the other countries in order to fund their operations. And it was hysterical, because at that moment, Pat Buchanan looked at Tom, and there was this look of astonished incredulity on his face, saying, okay, we were funding the communists in Italy at the time, and Brayden didn't deny it. And afterwards, Buchanan was needling him about it, and Brayden was saying, well, obviously, you want to be able to fund these people in order to keep track of them. Well, no, you can keep track of them without actually funding them and helping them to destroy property and kill people. There are better ways of doing it, but if actually you're trying to prevent them from committing acts of terrorism and mayhem, what you do is you find out where they're doing such things, then you go shut them down. But if you're funding them, what you're doing is you're helping them perpetrate their crimes. But that's very commonplace. And what Brayden was tacitly admitting, basically, was that the CIA was running these communist groups in Europe. And the same thing is going on with radical groups here in the United States, whether you're talking about radical groups of the flavor that were involved in the so-called battle in Seattle, or whether you're talking about radical groups and individuals of the sort that Hal Turner and people of a somewhat neo-Nazi outlook on life would represent. And, of course, if you take a look at what's gone on in the last 5 or 6 years with the so-called radical Muslims that are always being marched at routine intervals before the cameras as terrorist cells, most of these groups are pathetic, marginalized people who are brought together by somebody who was an FBI agent. You can see that time and time again in the court filings, that the FBI stage manages these so-called terrorist plots, provides these so-called terrorist plots with financing and material help, and introduces them to a game plan for a terrorist attack, and then arrests them and brings them before a federal grand jury and charges them with terrorism and says, see, our anti-terrorism program must be working. Here's another terrorist coup that we, or terrorist plot, rather, that we managed to disrupt. That happens from time to time. It's all a matter of cynical stage management.
In fact, there's a trial now. It's going on. They're going to the third trial. There's a group. They're called the Six. I've forgotten what the something Six. Supposedly, they were going to blow up the Sears Tower. They've already been tried twice, and the jury realized, of course, the whole thing was an FBI contrived. It was all contrived. But they're going to bring them back a third time. They're going to go after them again and again and again until they can send them to prison for life, because they've got to prove to the American people that the threat of terrorism is really real. I mean, my goodness, the government's protecting us from the terrorists who are actually being actively recruited by FBI agitators, agent provocateurs.
Yeah.
And it's just like it was over in Ireland, of course, where they had the Irish Republican Army killing people and planting bombs in London, and then we find out that the number two man in the IRA over in Dublin was actually a British agent, and the other man in charge of killing people who were trying to infiltrate the IRA and torturing them was actually also a British agent.
Yeah.
And, of course, they were exposed, and they were both executed by their confreres, justifiably so. I hate to say that, but these are men with certainly no redeeming social values. These are people who are willing to betray the organization and betray everybody else, but they were actually killing. They were killing people in Great Britain, They were killing people, you know, who joined the IRA, accusing them of being infiltrators where they themselves were the infiltrators. This is the sort of thing that goes on all throughout the world.
Yeah, there were the genteel people who were using power drills to drill holes in the kneecaps of people that knew were innocent. I mean, that we hear about the IRA kneecapping people. And of course, the provos, as they were called, the boyos, there were some fairly rough specimens in there as well, but the people who pioneered that type of treatment were people who were working for British intelligence. And the other thing I find really interesting about this whole discussion is the fact that you take a look at, once again, the way that this is all depicted in the media. The media is a very active part of the grand delusion here. I mean, they take their cues from government, they perform stenography rather than journalism, and they lead people to accept the established narrative and be directed, led by the nose, by the people who are planning our future for us, and it really is quite offensive.
But, of course, this is not our government. Our government, exactly. I believe, is global. There's an invisible government that works behind it, ties into the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, the Group of 30. You can read about them up on the Internet. Find out if it's really true. And then, of course, understand that they do hire professional assassins. We're putting together a four-tape set on that very subject, available for Radio Liberty. Our guest has been William Grieg, and we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program. Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program. Why don't you get out your website and the other information, which I got so involved in the program tonight that I forgot to let you get out earlier.
The easiest way to find my material is to go to willgrieg.com. Willgrieg.com is going to be the archive for a lot of what I have written and also the point of contact for people who want to buy my books, including my most recent one, which is entitled Liberty and Eclipse. And if you go to willgrieg.com, to the upper right-hand corner of the opening page, there's a list of external links, and the very first one is Pro Libertate. That's a Latin phrase. It means for freedom. And Pro Libertate is the blog that I write and maintain. I try to update it between 3 and 5 times a week as my conditions and circumstances permit. I try to write a 1,200 to 2,000 word essay. I'm trying to start writing in a briefer fashion to make them more reader-friendly, but these are not mere random observations about what's going on in the world. These are fully referenced works of what I call investigative polemics. I'm an opinion writer. I try to combine that with investigative journalism. The focus is always on individual liberty. And at the bottom of every essay, there's a link where people can go to order my book, Liberty and Eclipse. I do want to emphasize, once again, when we talk about the fact that there's going to be this effort to exacerbate the natural tensions and frustrations that attend our economic downturn, that people do not allow themselves to be seduced into genuine lawlessness. Genuine lawlessness, of course, means violations of the non-aggression principle. The non-aggression principle dictates that it is never proper to initiate violence against somebody else. You have the right to defend yourself against aggressive violence. It doesn't matter who the aggressor is. But you cannot initiate violence. That is lawlessness. And it's an application of the Golden Rule. The Golden Rule is the most important principle of civilized life. If we were to live the Golden Rule, the two great commandments, we would have none of the difficulties we're discussing right now. If we could compel those who exercise authority on our behalf in government to live by the Golden Rule, we wouldn't have the difficulties we're discussing. And once again, I want people to understand that when somebody introduces himself as a friend and starts trying to incite you to do something that is objectively wrong, objectively a violation of the Golden Rule and the non-aggression principle, you're probably dealing with somebody who is by no means your friend or your natural ally. Be aware of that. Be astute to it. Be as wise as a serpent and as harmless as a dove. That advice comes from the best source I can think of.
Well, I've read it. Okay, fine. Well, I guess this evening has been Will Grieg. Will, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Look forward to having you with us next week, and I hope that you will get me that Brzezinski reference, and I hope that you'll get me some copies of Liberty and Eclipse.
I will.
It's
do
a great
both.
Book.
I promise.
Bye-bye.
God bless.
We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and we hope you enjoyed our conversation with Will Grieg. It's always a pleasure to have him on, certainly one of the most articulate people we have in our camp. Well, this is the time when I certainly want to mention, if you'd like to hear my interview with Clark Brewster, who is Carol Howe's attorney, and actually they wanted to send her to prison. Why? Because she was a patriot, and she had tried to expose the terrorists in Elohim City who were intimately involved with Timothy McVeigh, but we can't let the American people know that, or the fact that he was working for a special forces unit, and actually he told that to Terry Nichols, who tried to bring that out. He told it to a man who's in prison, who wrote a book, A Secret Worth Dying For, and he told it actually to his sister, Jennifer, and that's covered in a book on OK Bomb, written by Jim Keith, who died under very mysterious circumstances shortly before his publisher died under very mysterious circumstances shortly before his wife, or his estranged wife, died under very mysterious circumstances. Could those things happen in America? Yes, ladies and gentlemen, they really could. So we do have the interview with Clark Brewster, Carol Howe's attorney. And, of course, we have the other material. We have, of course, a four-tape set on the murder of Martin Luther King. And, of course, people who actually attended the trial, where it was a four-week trial. I'd at one time said 4 months. It was actually a four-week trial put on by Mr. Pepper at the behest of the King family. And the jury found that the CIA was involved in killing King. But because of the control over the media, you've never heard about it, but you'll hear the four-tape set. And, of course, you can get the book written by Mr. Pepper, An Act of State. And then we have the four-tape set, interviews with the people, the survivors of the USS Liberty, which was attacked by the Israelis at the behest of the American government, and William Strange McNamara, incidentally, the permanent assistant chairman of the North American chapter of the Trilateral Commission. But, of course, when back in 1967, why McNamara was the Secretary of the Defense, and he sent those boys over there to die. They were all supposed to die. And when the Israeli attack with torpedo boats and special forces and airplanes didn't kill them all, why, of course, the survivors were threatened with their lives until they'd be killed if they ever revealed what happened 20 years later. Why, of course, they came forward. We have interviews with four of them. We have a excellent video. We have an excellent DVD, different. And then, of course, we have a syllabus. And, of course, you can get them all as the Liberty Special. You need to get this information. You need to help us get it out. If you want to understand how they created this whole problem, why you need to get our pamphlet on the financial meltdown, our pamphlet on the history of money. We have a new book we're carrying. It was written back in 1935. It tells how these same people created the Great Depression. And it was actually, forward is written by Senator Owen. It's written by Gertrude Coogan. You can get them up on Amazon, $39.95. They only had a couple of copies. We have it for about almost a third of that, well, a little over a third of that. You need to understand that there's a conscious effort to keep you from understanding what's going on. The best book on this subject is Ed Griffin's book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, My Talk, called The Financial Tsunami with a Syllabus, is vitally important. It was given 3 or 4 years ago, but it tells you exactly what was going to happen, and it just followed exactly along that line and told you about the derivatives, the carry trade, and the hedge funds, and how all of these things were being used to create a situation that was going to lead to an economic collapse. So it's the financial tsunami. Then we also carry the book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, by Professor Sutton. Goal for Survival, and certainly a Goal for Investment. I think two other books we carry. And then a book called Fiat Money Inflation in France. If you'd like to know more, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a catalog on long-term storage food or on a Berkey or on the health products which you should be laying in for yourself and your family, call us at 1-800-544-8927. And then we ask, of course, you to pray for America, to pray for revival, because this is a spiritual battle, and there are powerful spiritual forces aligned against our nation, against freedom. And, of course, we ask you to pray for radio liberty, for our provision and protection.